to Perspectives, the podcast from the Public Health Review at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for joining us. I'm Amanda, one of the producers. The conversation today is going to be about storytelling and health, both on an individual level and on a more community and public health level. Our other producer, Mariah, went to a workshop about storytelling last spring at the School of Public Health and thought that it might be a good topic to explore for an episode of the podcast. And she definitely did not need to convince me. I love talking about storytelling. I worked briefly at StoryCorps a long time ago, which is the audio storytelling project where friends or relatives interview each other and they select one to play on National Public Radio each week on Friday mornings. They make you cry like maybe 82% of the time. It's very cool. So I've been on board the storytelling train since then, and I was really excited to talk with some people who have thought about storytelling a lot. So first we have Allison Myers, who gave that original workshop that Mariah saw, and she's now the director of an organization called Story Collab. And then our second interview is with Dr. Ben Trappe, who is a physician and also an associate professor of medicine and pediatrics, as well as the associate director of the Medical School's Center for the Art of Medicine. So I really enjoyed talking with them both, and I hope you enjoy listening. Well, I'm really excited to talk to you, Allison. You had given a presentation. This is how I first heard about your work. You gave a presentation this spring at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. It was called The Power of First-Person Storytelling in Public Health. So I'd love if you could introduce yourself and the work you're doing now just a little bit. And if you could not try to summarize that whole presentation, because that would not be realistic, but give us a little taste for folks who couldn't hear that presentation. That would be great.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So I did that presentation last spring. It's something pretty near and dear to my heart. I've been doing storytelling work, particularly first-person narrative-focused work for about 17 years in lots of different areas in terms of whether it's public health or higher education, working with refugees, lots of different arenas. But a lot of the work that I do is focused in public health and has been for a number of years. What I talked a lot about during that session was because there is a lot of storytelling, as I think you mentioned in your notes to me, that you know, everybody's doing storytelling in some way, and it's a big buzzword, and maybe not everybody's doing it so well or so ethically. But one of the, for me and, you know, the organization that I work with and, the work that I've been doing is really focused on first-person narratives. And there's a particular power in that. And I think as it's relative to public health, in lots of different areas, but I really believe that people are the experts of their own experiences, and they really should be able to tell their own stories and make decisions about, you know, how they're going to tell that, what's important to tell, you know, what's not so important, and who gets to hear it. And so those are all components of this first-person narrative that I think are really important to public health in particular, but in all of the work, really. What I love about stories, again, focused on real people's real stories, is that stories, different than public health messaging, don't tell us, and I know I said this during this presentation because it's kind of my mantra, but stories don't tell us how to think or how to feel or what to feel or what to do. Different than, I think, public health messaging. They're not advised, they're not constructed, right, to deliver a particular message. I think most people would agree with this, that we don't like to be sold or told, right? We like to engage with something. We like to hear from people, their own experiences, and then make our own decisions, use that information to engage in a story or in maybe an experience and then decide for ourselves. So that's really, for me, the power of the first person narrative. So I did talk about that a lot. And I think I gave some case studies and showed some stories from some different projects just to show how different organizations or different groups are using first person narratives, especially with this digital, you know, media construction in public health. And public health work. I mean, I think just in particular to public health, maybe, again, it's that idea of representation, which is not just relevant to public health, but that people really should be able to represent themselves and their own communities rather than having other people do it for them, which forever is what was happening. Before we had access to, we all had access to all kinds of programs on our smartphones. And before there were, video editing programs on Adobe, people that went to school for it and big communication houses, they were the ones making the media. They were the ones, just people that went to school, right? Decided, what stories were important to be told and how they should be told. And so, access to media creation really changed everything. But not everybody, we're all consumers of media, but not everybody, and people now create lots of stuff. I often think it's a lot of kind of silly cat videos and things like that. So it's not always ethical or effective. And so this work has given us an opportunity to help people, not give them a voice because they have one, but to help people use their voice in service of a story that they want to tell, give them the tools to do it, help them do it, in an impactful way, and then help them think about how to share those, how they want to share those stories. So I think that's generally what I talked about. I guess I would say, in public health, we often, this is what I find in a lot of the projects that I've been working on, when people are coming to me saying, different state departments of public health, which I'm doing a lot of work with right now, especially around maternal health, which is, I think, also was a focus of that particular session that you referenced. But we don't often listen, or people in public health, really busy, but we don't often listen enough to patients and to communities. We're focused on data, we're focused on protocol, but there's a lot of information about the patient experiences that really aren't being heard. And stories and these story processes are, they're different than focus groups or intake forms or surveys. They're really different. There's a lot more nuance. The other piece is there's, at least in the way that I'm talking about it, where it's done in a small group, of people with similar kinds of stories, it's really a community building process. And so the process is equally as important as the outcome, the end media product. So I'll stop there because I'm saying a lot of stuff and maybe I've over-answered.
No, that's great. No, I was hoping there's, lots of directions to go in, and you brought up a bunch of them. I want to come back to the idea of the community because I think that's really interesting. But I also wanted to talk, you mentioned ethics a couple of times, and I kind of want to talk more about the ethics of telling stories, gathering stories, sharing stories. And you kind of mentioned this, just that stories and storytelling, they have become kind of commercialized and commodified, and there's some interesting things and there's some worrying things, I think, especially in digital spaces where, you don't quite know how to regulate who accesses it, how is it used. So I guess I just sort of broadly wanted to know what thoughts you have about that, and how do you feel like we should go about using the power of stories in an ethical way, and, asking people to share their stories in an ethical way?
Yeah, I do. I have a lot of feelings about that, or thoughts about that. I do think the first piece is asking, inviting people to tell their stories and creating the space for them. I think the biggest thing is, especially in vulnerable communities, they feel like forever that their stories have been taken from them, right? And used in ways supposed to be, for their good, but without their involvement in the decision-making of how the stories were told and how they're going to be shared. And so, it just, at least in the process that I do in my organization, that's part of it, is involving the storytellers from the get-go and being really clear up front. Say if you have a state health department that wants to, I'll just use to go with maternal health because that's what I've been doing a lot of lately, and that's how we connected in that presentation. So they're like, oh, we have some, we want to address maternal mortality, and there's a lot of problems right now in the U.S. Around comorbidities and all kinds of things that are not going well. And so we would like to involve community members. And so then the first thing is thinking about, what are you trying to do? How are you thinking about sharing the stories? And often it's like, we're not really clear. We want them, we would like to share them with providers. We hope that, hearing the stories will give providers more information from the patient's perspective of what's happening, what's being, sometimes what's being done well and how to amplify that, and sometimes what's not being done well. But, and so then, you know, what we talk about is, well, let's think about how are you going to recruit? Cause that's really important. And that you engage maybe first off with people who are already, you know, mom advocates, right? Who are already involved and who are already taking some leadership in this arena. And you invite them to help design it, because I think that's really important, the process. So, you know, already, you know, first of all, just in general, in telling the stories, I think storyteller well-being is like a number one focus. And that's really for us, you know, so that starts with how, you know, how you're talking about the project, you know, keeping people informed, making sure, you know, like we always offer several, as we're recruiting, information sessions, so people can come and meet me, who's going to be facilitating it, and ask questions like, how are you going to show the stories? You know, how, you know, can I change my mind? You know, all of that, who owns the stories? And so we talk about all of those things really upfront. But in terms of storyteller well-being, some of the things to really consider are, again, that the process is as important as the product. And that's really creating a safe space where people feel validated and heard, like you're really bearing witness to each other's stories, and supporting throughout that whole process. We really pay attention to culture and power dynamics and the differentials there. I think, you know, you can't always fix those, but I think being aware of them and having that, you know, as part of the conversation as you're, you know, building together the process, you know. For example, like one of the things that I don't do is some people say, oh, well, we want to have some provider stories and we'd like to have some patient stories. Can we have them in the same workshop? And the answer is, it's not a good idea, because there's already a power differential there and people are not going to feel safe or as comfortable to share the stories that they really want to tell. And that's the space is for them to tell the story they really want to tell. So that's one, another thing. Let's see, paying attention to where people are in their experience is really important. For example, if people that are currently experiencing some kind of trauma or have PTSD, it's really not appropriate to bring them into a story process. I have sometimes people will call me and say, oh, I want to do a digital storytelling workshop with homeless people in my community. And one, they don't have any experience doing that. They are really well-intentioned, but it's like, that's really not a very good idea. I don't think the ethics on that, I don't think that's really supporting what's best for the people whose stories you would be eliciting, right? So, you know, really paying attention to the screening and where people are in their experience is super important. If you are doing something where it could really trigger, for example, another project that I've been working with is people with postpartum psychosis, or people who have experienced, not with that, who have experienced that, who have experienced postpartum psychosis. And, you know, I mean, I say, you know, I'm a really great listener and I'm a really nice person, but I am not a trained social worker or therapist. And it would not be ethical for us to have this without having someone with those credentials and that, you know, licensing in that space in with us and through this process available, you know, letting people know that person is going to be there and having them participate throughout the workshop and being available, you know, outside of the workshop for people to process. And so, you know, when I work with different organizations, I require them to bring that person on as part of the process. I think this is another really important one, especially, you know, you think about HIPAA and different kinds of identifying information. So also part of the process, again, we don't tell people you can't tell the story. You know, we want people to tell the story they want to tell. And so we help them throughout to think about, you know, how are they going to be safe? You know, maybe it's stories around sexual assault. And, but they want to show their story publicly. So what are the choices that they need to make to keep themselves safe? And that may be deciding on visuals that don't, you know, that are more artistic or, you know, that don't show faces or identifying characteristics, or maybe they don't include their name. They might want to leave out certain details of their story. You know, they can allude to things without going into details. And so just helping people make choices throughout the process, in terms of content and thinking about that, who their audiences are. I think another really, really important issue around ethics is consent. And it seems like a pretty obvious one, but I know, you know, when you think about different research, the IRB and all, you know, the things that you have to get approved and, you know, the consent form, but, for us, it's, we really are clear that consent is not a one and done idea. It can, it's ongoing. We talk about it when we're recruiting, here's how the stories, here's the intention. We're going to be open to hearing, you know, people who decide to participate. We want to hear from them how they want to share their stories, and you're going to be invited to participate in, you know, discussions around how the stories will be shared and with whom and all of that. And so that discussion is up front before people even decide if they're going to do it or not. And, you know, the information sessions, we talk about it, and the workshop, we talk about it, you know, your story, and it goes hand in hand, I think, with ownership. Your story is yours. You own the story start to finish. You own the decisions. We're here to facilitate and to help you make choices. We're going to share our expertise with you, you know, from having done this, you know, just in terms of visual narrative or how you might want to structure the framework of the story or those kinds of things. But there are suggestions. And at any point you say, you know, I really want to do it this way. Great. So you own the story throughout the process of making it, but also when it's done and you get to make decisions. You know, I'm giving you permission to share it here in another workshop with other storytellers, but I don't want it shared on social media. I don't want it shared, you know. And so, you know, we have a list of all the possible ways that we might want to share it, and we ask them to make choices about what they're comfortable with. With, you know, the knowledge that if they say yes now and in 6 months something changes, that they can always change their mind. And even, you know, for us, even when people give consent to beyond the show it in a workshop, if people say yes, you can show it online or you can show it at a presentation on the, you know, top on maternal health stories. We don't put all the stories up, you know, sometimes we curate them. And so I will still, in 6 months later or a year later, if I decide, you know, for maternal health week or whatever, that I would like to share some stories, even though I have that consent form, I'll go check it. But, and you said yes, I'm still going to contact you and say, hey, I know you said, you know, you made this story with us a year ago. You know, this is what I'm thinking. Are you still okay with that? And so I think that gives people a feeling of security in that they can retain and maintain the decision about what's theirs and how they want to share it. I think those are some of the main, here's another one. I've run into this in terms of distribution and sharing. I think it's really important if you're sharing like in a public space, you know, a presentation, to preface the sharing of the stories with explaining what the process was. These are real people. They're real stories. They're not constructed for public health messaging. These are not people who are filmmakers. And these are, you know, their own experiences. They don't represent the organization or, you know, whoever funded it. They really made the choices because I think if you don't, I have had a situation, just to give you an example, where it was a public health situation. And I had given them, I wasn't able to be there at the very beginning. And usually I might, if I'm invited, I would do that kind of intro, but I had given them that these are the important things to do. Make sure you explain so people understand what they're seeing. Storytellers were in the audience and, you know, they showed the stories. They're really emotional. They're really vulnerable for a lot of people. And somebody, well-meaning person, probably I think was a public health professional, you know, stood up and said something like, you know, well, I thought that second one was a lot better than that first one. And the messaging could have been a little bit stronger. Da, 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 da. And so, and it was just like horrifying. I think I came in at that point. And so it was terrible. It was really damaging. And so just making sure that it's set up properly. You know, for us, we turn off all comments on stories if we've posted them on YouTube, because these are not open for people's critique. They're people's stories. You can watch them. They're not downloadable and you can't make comments, good or bad, on them. And I think those are some other ways you can protect people in terms of their safety and storytelling.
Yeah, those are all important things to think about, especially I think kind of everything you said underlined that balancing of the process, like the importance of the process. And I think, yeah, that comes through with that last example, especially. Yeah.
Because it's not just, I will say one more thing. I think experienced facilitators in all areas of the process is really important. I think because storytelling is such a buzzword, you look on LinkedIn or whatever, and everybody says, I'm a storyteller, I'm a public health story. And that's not to say that people are, because we all have our own stories, but I think it does, there are a lot of really important components to the process, especially if you're creating digital media. Which is what, I'm really focused on is digital stories, podcast, also story mapping. And it's not the same as an interview. It's not the same as being a public health comms person or a comms person in general. It's, 50% sort of therapeutic space, deep listening practices, facilitation skills, tech skills, creative skills. It's a really, like all of those pieces are really important so that you can guide people through in a way that they feel safe and held and honored throughout the process. So that's another thing that I would say is really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned deep listening, and that when I was looking through the Story Center principles, one of them was listening is hard, and that the explanatory paragraph around that talks about the emotional labor of listening. And so I was just wondering if you had thoughts about, who is in a position to do that labor and who isn't, and, and for what reasons, and just kind of how that might affect the stories that gets told and the stories that we kind of hear and that are more kind of widely circulated. That makes sense.
Yeah. I think everybody could be a deep listener, but I think most people aren't. I can't tell you how many times, we've all experienced this. You're talking to somebody and they've got their phone and they're they're flipping through, checking messages, looking at their, smartwatch or whatever, and not really, really listening. And so for me, for us at Story Collab, at Story Center, I think the best thing that you bring to people is the gift of presence, really. I think that's what listening is when I'm in a space, I'm all in. I don't bring my phone. I'm not thinking about messages. I'm not thinking about what I need to make for dinner. I really am trying to hold the space for the people who are really being brave and being vulnerable to share something that's important to them. And it's not my place to decide if it's good enough, quote unquote, or if it's brave enough, or if it's the right, quote unquote, story. It's, my job is really to listen and to hold that space. I think I'm really paying attention sometimes to what I think they want to say, not what I think they're going to say, or, because of whatever, because no matter how open we are, we have preconceived ideas about the world, about a space, about a group, about communities. And so it's really being aware of that and doing your best in a kind of from a humble place of service, I think, to really try to listen to what people want to say. I also find this is really kind of strange, but sometimes it's really important to listen to what people aren't saying, because often that's where the story is. And that's something that's a skill that takes a lot of practice. And I think listening takes practice and intentionality. And presence. And that's something that you have to work at. If it doesn't come naturally, and especially our, modern day era of, media coming at us, all the time, we're not wired that way. But I don't think it's limited to certain people in terms of, and so that other people aren't going to get heard. It's just working to become those people that are good listeners, deep listeners. And just in terms of, because I think maybe what you're getting at is that does that limit who gets to be heard? Because maybe there's not a story facilitator in the area. But, and that's really the focus for me of the work, you know, for me, it really at Story Club, we really have a social justice foundation and this idea that we really want to help people tell the stories that need to be told who don't always have a platform. Again, I think I said this in the beginning, we don't give people a voice. Nobody gives people a voice. And that is another thing, people, that's a kind of a power differential. Everybody has a voice. We, you know, it's just not everybody has an audience or the tools to be able to share it or, you know, the platform. And so, you know, a big part of the work that I do and the, you know, the organizations that I'm looking to collaborate are working in spaces where often vulnerable communities, what we would call maybe marginalized communities, aren't always being listened to, and then going in and working with them, collaborating with them to help them share the stories that they want to share. So it's really finding, it's partnering, collaborating, serving, listening, and supporting people in that process.
Mm-hmm. Well, returning kind of to the idea of health, do you feel like you've seen storytelling contribute to healing? And I guess I was thinking, you know, not just on an individual level, but on a community level, because I think, you know, when you talked about the process of, you know, the storytelling is happening as a group, I think that can create a lot of, you know, dynamics that wouldn't otherwise be felt.
Yeah. Yes. For sure, individual level healing. I'm sure you can imagine, you know, every day we still get letters. I still get email, not letters. Nobody writes those anymore. I still get emails and texts from people from years ago that say, you know, that process, I've been in therapy for years, and that process, that, you know, 3-day or 4-day or 6-week storytelling process with you all was one of the most transformative healing experiences I've ever had. So, you know, so that's definitely a true statement that storytelling and being heard is really healing. But in terms of community level, I would also say yes. I mean, I don't really have a way to measure it necessarily, but I could say anecdotally, yes. I can give you an example. Well, I started to say this earlier, and I can elaborate on it, but this idea of involving storytellers in the whole process where it's possible, you know, I guess in many ways it's always possible, but especially around public health sort of programs and outreach, because a lot of it is to better, the reason they're doing the storytelling workshops or the storytelling program is maybe to better understand patient experience. Maybe it's to understand the nuances of bias that might be happening in patient care, or, you know, what are the social determinants of health and how are people experiencing those and the ways that they talk about them, or, you know, around stigma. So there's, you know, so all of those are some of the reasons. It might also be to understand what are the barriers to, you know, to getting mammograms or screenings or, you know, that sort of thing, or to the barriers to accessing healthcare. And so whatever the goals are of the organization, where you can involve the people that you're, the storytellers or the potential audiences that you're going to be working with in the development. So a lot of, and if it's a research project, this is a term that's familiar, that community-based participatory research is wonderful for this kind of work. And I think the more that you do that, the more that there's healing as a community, because they're driving it. There's this sense of we are identifying this issue in our community. We're making the decisions, or, you know, co-deciding with, you know, maybe some folks that have experience in this particular process to decide whose stories are we going to invite and how are we going to do that and how are we going to share them. And so I think that there's a real healing in that. I'll give you an example. So I've done several projects with the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, and they're one of my favorite groups to work with. They do everything right. You know, it's long-term. They really think about the ethics. They think about, you know, all of this. And I've worked with them several times. One of the projects, actually, they're all of the projects that I've done with them are CBPR projects. So the first one that I did with them was with, It was with two immigrant and refugee communities, from Somali immigrants and refugees, and Spanish speaking from all over, you know, Latin America, which is a lot of different groups, right? They always tend to get lumped into the language group. But both of those communities in the Rochester area were at a high level of type 2 diabetes. And most of it was, I mean, you imagine that maybe it's because they came to the US and then their diet is horrible, but a lot of them had it already before. And so they wanted to understand what was happening and what were the barriers for self-health care management. You know, why weren't people, you know, they know you should change your diet, you should, you know, take your medications, you should exercise. They know the health education components, but what's happening? And so they brought together these two groups and we did a workshop over 5 days. And so we were working in Spanish and Somali and of course English. And so, and you know, initially they were like, we don't know if this is gonna work. They're different religious groups and you know, and so like, there are just lots of things that there's lots of variables that may make this challenging, you know, and I wanted to say, trust me, I've done this, you know, with lots of different people. But of course, you know, I didn't say that. But I said, well, let's try. I think it's going to work and we can assess at the end of the day. And then, you know, let's see what you guys think. And what happened was, you know, I decided to show some stories around food and food, you know, people telling stories about how they learned to make, you know, tortillas with their grandmother and, you know, different things. And so then before we, you know, people are sharing all these stories and finding common ground and, you know, go through the process. They're sharing, you know, really important stories around their own experiences. And by the end of the workshop, everyone's saying, we don't want this to end. You know, they're bringing each other food from their own traditions. This particular workshop was probably 5 years ago. And, you know, just talked to Mayo last week. You know, they said, you know, we still see people from that experience and they're still talking about how empowering that was, how healing it was for the community, how, you know, that they feel that it really has begun to make a difference. They, you know, and they're using these stories in a clinical trial to understand if, you know, watching a story told by somebody, you know, with cultural relevance, obviously, in your language, does it have an impact, not just on self-reporting? Yes, that makes me want to take care of, you know, better manage my healthcare, but biometrically measuring over time, you know, did the people that watched the stories and had a discussion about their own experiences versus the people that didn't watch a story and just got the healthcare information, has it made a difference in their health outcomes and their health, personal health management? And it has. But I think just in terms of that community building and healing, I would say that would be a good example. That was a long-winded answer, but I think that we see that a lot, especially when you involve communities in building the project.
Yeah, what an interesting example. I wanted to ask you, I think one of my last questions was going to be kind of research in the role of storytelling, and that's a great example. I think, you know, for a long time, qualitative research, I think in general, has kind of struggled to be taken as seriously, you know, as research as compared to, you know, quantitative mm-hmm. numbers based research. And I think that has, you know, there's been a lot of development in the last several decades. And I think, you know, most people would acknowledge like there is a role for qualitative research. There's important data there. But I think, you know, there's still a lot about how we view research and, you know, how we collect data and what is data, even if it's qualitative data. I mean, it does tend to be, unless you're doing the processes that you're talking about, like community-based participatory, which is, you know, not the norm. It's mm-hmm. it's great that it's happening more, but that's still
it's harder. It takes more work.
Right.
I think it's really worth it, but it takes more work.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there just hasn't been as much attention and in most research to the process that you're talking about. And I think, yeah, that is, I don't know, I see that as a big barrier to, you know, to research that doesn't feel like it's kind of exploitative in some sense, mm-hmm. you know. So this is my rambling now. Not that you were rambling before. I'm just, this is just such an interesting area, and I would love to talk about it for a long time. But my question, I guess, is kind of about, you know, storytelling as qualitative research. And does it make sense to think about it like that, or as kind of a tool of qualitative research? Or does it feel like, you know, it's kind of a different thing and it's for a different purpose?
I mean, I do think storytelling has its place in qualitative research. I think, you know, it definitely doesn't replace quantitative, but I think it certainly can complement. I think it can help us understand nuances better. And, you know, I'm trying to think if I can give you another not so long-winded example. I think this wasn't as robust in terms of, you know, CBPR all the way through this project. But it was, this was also a number of years ago in working with Puerto Rican American teen moms. And the idea, what they were trying to understand, it was sexual and reproductive health work. And they were trying to understand, you know, what kinds of changes or what kinds of education or what kinds of programs needed to be offered. And so I think they went into it, and we were, you know, I was brought in as to, you know, I have been a co-PI, but, you know, I do collaborate with a lot of academics and, you know, and research. And I think it makes sense because they, you know, I can facilitate the process. They can take participatory observation notes and, you know, and then they can really run the actual research part. Because it's a lot to try to do it all, and most people aren't trained and they don't have time. But that process, so I think, you know, the research that they really went into it thinking that, you know, maybe we need to have, you know, more sex ed, you know, information in schools, maybe, you know, provide more condoms. I don't really know what all the you know, kind of what they thought they were going to get. But what really came out in the stories, and that, you know, they then analyzed the themes and what was, you know, what was happening in the stories. And they did involve the storytellers saying, what do you think's happening here? What do you think, you know, this person is talking about? We did about 6 workshops. And what came out was that actually a lot of these young women said, you know, many of them had kind of left home, or they had, you know, for different reasons, and, you know, maybe had dropped out of school, were struggling with housing, were struggling, you know, with jobs. And so what they said was, one thing that was really interesting was that actually that they were really happy that they had had a child, because it really, in some ways, was the first time where they felt a different sense of meaning and being needed and family in a way that they maybe weren't having because of their situation. But the other thing that was really, really, I think, was pretty eye-opening for the researchers was that they said, you know, what we really want, this was the first time that I felt like when I had another human to take care of, I wanted to get my life together. And what I really wanted was to get my GED. What I really wanted was to get secure housing and a better job and, you know, build a better social structure and community. But the barriers were things like transportation and daycare and, you know, programs that, you know, skills building programs. And so then what came out of that was, oh, well, what we thought we were going to spend money on to address this situation is not relevant at all, right? These are these other things where we can actually support and make a difference. And we're getting that information. And I don't think they would have gotten it in the same way if they'd given them a survey or had a focus group. You know, it was a creative process where they got to talk about, you know, how exciting it was to have, you know, their mini me, you know, the really sweet stories. And yet, and there were subtext of being mistreated or being, you know, stereotyped and all of these things that came out, and then understanding, like, what is it that you really want or what you really need. And so it was a really interesting process. So yeah, I do think there is a place for it. And I think it can certainly complement quantitative research.
Yeah. Well, you have given us so much to think about. I wanted to ask you before we wrap up, just to talk about kind of what you're doing now, because I know you moved from Story Center. Mm-hmm. And just kind of what are you doing? And then if people want to find out more, I know you have there's a website for Story Collab.
Yes, it's in process. We're doing some renovations on it. So I worked at Story Center for about 16, 17 years. Some great work there with great colleagues. And I am now executive director of a new organization called Story Collab. And we're housed in a research and innovation center as part of a university, but I'm, doing work all over. I'm doing some work in the state of Indiana in public health and in Michigan and, lots of places in the UK, largely focused on public health, but not solely focused on public health, doing, a lot of similar work in digital storytelling, podcasting, participatory media, which is really what this is, storytelling based, but where you're really involving the storytellers in the creation of the media, right? Instead of, getting their stories and creating it for them. We're doing some story mapping. We're doing some, really large scale projects where we're incorporating storytelling components or media, participatory media production in other, larger projects. So that's what I'm doing now. And I'm really loving it. What we are able to do I wasn't really able to do before is really help people with larger strategies around their storytelling programs and distribution, that sort of thing. And also building some documentary pieces around the process or that, maybe you do these smaller, the digital stories with people. And then we collaborate to develop kind of like the macro level state of maternal health and the state of whatever, And so there's these different components. So, looking at different kinds of media and data to help tell a more nuanced, larger story in some of these projects. So that's a lot of what I'm doing now.
That sounds super interesting. Well, thank you so much for your time and all of your thoughts. Is there anything else that you wanted to mention?
I don't think so. Sorry. Yeah, we did cover a lot of ground. We did. Thank you. No, thank you. I appreciate you inviting me to share some of that. I mean, I'm really passionate about the work. I sometimes still pinch myself that I get to do this work and support people's stories. So I love talking about it.
Yeah, well, I love talking about it too. So
thank you.
Let's just start with introductions. Can you just give me a brief introduction both to yourself and to the Center for the Art of Medicine?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm Ben Trappe. I'm an internal medicine and pediatric hospitalist at the University of Minnesota. And I am one of the two directors for the Center for the Art of Medicine in the medical school, which is a center that kind of strives to promote and kind of create this curiosity and creativity through the arts and kind of incorporating the arts into medical education and into medical practice through a variety of things, but with a real focus on kind of the stories at the heart of medical practice.
And I saw that you all recently had a story slam. Is that right? So we're talking about...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
October 13th, but that was on October 11th. Can you just tell me a little bit about what a story slam is and how they work?
Yeah, so we did our first story slam in 2018. We were kind of asked by, and this is before CFAM, which is what we call the Center for the Art of Medicine, even existed. Maren Ellison, my co-director at CFAM, and I were kind of asked to by the Metro Minnesota Council on Graduate Medical Education, MMCGME, which is this big governing or kind of resource giving body for all the residency and fellowship training programs in the Twin Cities. They kind of just provide kind of some central resources for all of these trainees in the Twin Cities and training programs. And they wanted to do something to kind of help create community in the hopes of like promoting wellness, and had based off of some stuff that actually had already been done at Hennepin County Medical Center, wanted to try to do a storytelling event. And so we, you know, we got a committee of people together, and we honestly, like when we were planning the first one, we thought we were going to have to bribe people to show up and bribe people to tell stories. So we had like, you know, we had door prizes, and we were talking about, you know, like having like a committee to select a winner of the Story Slam, and like giving, I mean, like really nice prizes to people, thinking that we would truly like have to bribe people to show up. But we were shocked at how many people were interested in submitting stories and interested in showing up. We had, we held it at Surly and their kind of one of their event spaces. And we were, you know, with, I think it held 160, and we're like, well, there's, you know, if we could get 160, we'd be lucky. And we ended up having to close registration because we had, you know, too many people. And so, you know, and it was just this, it was, you know, we had 17 storytellers, and they just told, which is probably too many. And they told these just incredible stories of like, you know, of heartbreaking experiences, funny experiences. And, you know, you could kind of see the audience, even though it was trainees from all over the cities and all sorts of different residencies and fellowships, that everyone was kind of seeing themselves in these stories, like that they were, that the difficulties of being a medical trainee are kind of universal, and that there's kind of community to be built, and kind of understanding that even though, like, you know, a surgery residency is very different from a pediatrics residency, but they're kind of the same in a lot of ways. And so based off the success of that, we did another one in 2019. We moved to a bigger venue that held 350, and we were like, well, for sure, you know, we don't have to worry about capacity. And then again, kind of like over, like we ended up having to kind of shut down registration beforehand. So at that point, we knew we were on to something, you know, that this is something people want to do. And so we actually studied that one, and found a lot of things that I think we expected, but maybe it was the way people described it was kind of surprising. So, you know, what we did is a qualitative analysis of like these surveys and like Twitter responses and post-it notes that we put on the table to kind of like try to get at, you know, why are people interested in coming? What do these things do? And what we found was that, you know, that people overwhelmingly kind of talked about that sense of connectedness and that sense of community, that sense that like, we are all experiencing the same things, and that the hardships of medical practice are universal, and that there's, and we know that is protective against burnout, the sense of kind of community and not being alone in the struggle of the things that you're experiencing. We also found that people kind of had a renewed sense of purpose, particularly like faculty really said that like hearing the stories of trainees was like inspiring and helped them kind of reconnect to why they were doing the things that they were like the careers that they had chosen, this kind of sense of renewal and hope. Yeah, that was the main thing, that this like people, it felt like people, they came because they were seeking that community and that sense of purpose. And so we've continued to do them every year. We actually, the one that was just a couple of days ago was our seventh. We obviously had to pivot to online during the pandemic. So we did two virtual ones. And then we've been back in person this is our third in-person one now, which we have at the Minneapolis Institute of Art, which is a, you know, it's a great, they have this great space to kind of the great place to hold an artistic thing. And, you know, we feed people and they come and hear amazing stories. And it's been really interesting too, to see that like we've sort of started to build this like culture of storytelling, that like this is something that's just normal now for people, and they know what it is, and that we don't have to convince them to come. And, you know, and we have 250 plus people like show up every time, and, you know, have a dozen or so storytellers. And it's been a really meaningful thing to see. And every, you know, and it's yeah, and it's just a joy to go and watch, you know, like to and we do them for medical students now too, a separate one. And so yeah, it's a really cool thing.
Well, I'm guessing when you must have had an inkling that that kind of need was out there. I mean, because you got involved in this work, was there something kind of in your own career, like anything in particular that made you think, yes, this is a direction we should explore?
You know, I mean, honestly, a lot of it was just like, I mean, yes, but a lot of it was just because I wanted that for my own life and practice, you know. So I, when I was in medical school, we had to do, I was always kind of knew I was going to be a doctor, but was kind of leaned toward the humanities. My family actually thought that I would not be a physician, that I would be like an English PhD or something, because I was good at science and math and stuff, but it was like really like literature that really like that got me really excited and, you know, would kind of make me light up. And in college, I was a biochemistry major because no, I went to a large public school and no one told me until it was too late that you could be an English major and also do pre-med or whatever. But I always took as many like English and, you know, literature classes and humanities classes that I could. But when I got to medical school and I went to Vanderbilt for medical school, we had to do, we had to stay in town and do some sort of research project between first and second year. And they had this kind of big fair where all these labs which like try to get the students to come, you know, work in their lab and say you could do this. And there was just somebody from the English department just sitting at this table, and I said, what are you doing here? And she's like, oh, you just you know, I'm a poet, but I teach creative writing, and if you you know, if you want to come like work with me for the summer, I'll just like give you feedback on your writing. And so that's what I did. I spent a summer working with her. And so when I applied for, and I did some other kind of, did my create your own like electives during medical school. And then when I came here for residency, our the now program director in MedPeds was also is very interested in writing. And so basically when I finished residency, we started this thing called the Storytelling Collaborative together, which was just kind of it truly was just for our own amusement, like to say like, okay, I want to be in a writing group and let's see if other people do and kind of put this thing together. So we started that in 2013 and really just started to identify that there's a lot of people in medicine who like have this part of them, this like kind of creative writing interest that they want to engage. And so really, you know, the interesting thing about the Story Slams is that we didn't create this idea. Like these things have been done in medicine before, but a lot of places had not been as successful as we were right off the bat, like that, you know, they would try something and like 10 people would show up or whatever. And we think, we don't know, but we think that having had these, like this writing group for clinicians for, you know, 5 years before our first Story Slam, kind of had started to create this, like to identify, like these are people we could go to ask for stories, right? That we have all these residents and faculty and fellows who are already kind of self-identifying as people who want to learn how to do this or want to get better at it. And similarly, like people who were excited about the prospect of it and could kind of get other people excited. And so we really think that's a big part of it, is like kind of creating a culture that values stories is a way to kind of like make the things kind of successful to start with. And that's what we encourage people to do. Like, don't start with a Story Slam, like start with something that's, you know, like just meet in a coffee shop and talk about writing for a year and then try to see, like, you know, then try to start something from there is like what we generally tell people. You can start with a Story Slam and people have, but I think it's just like people might not know what it is you're trying to do right away.
So. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And also partly just for the people who are working on, you know, or might be interested in telling their stories, just that, you know, that's an intimidating thing in and of
it
itself
is, 100%,
to have
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
yeah. To have that kind of just thinking about the writing for a while and just kind of mm-hmm. getting comfortable with that. That makes sense. I was wondering, you had said somewhere that you talked about the kind of the impact of organizing your story to tell it to others and that there's like physical mm-hmm. benefits of that. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of curious about, you know, there's a lot of people that would not be up for telling a story in front of a bunch of people, but does mm-hmm. it seem like just that process of thinking through your own story has some of those benefits too?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that you know, like with when we studied the story slam, we were kind of asking, you know, why are people coming to hear the stories and why people shared them, but, you know, did not look into what benefit people get out of creating them. And partly because we already know, like, it was actually the first kind of study that looked into kind of the benefits of what they deemed reflective writing was done way back in 1986 by this group at Southern Methodist in Texas. And what they did is they had people, college students, write about about like the most traumatic event they could think about, that they could think of, on three consecutive days for 15 minutes each day. So kind of like three different small writing exercises. And what they found is that, like, in the experimental group, those who wrote about a trauma, they had fewer doctor visits over the course of that semester, whereas the control group just wrote about something that was like something benign, like what they had for breakfast or what shoes they were wearing or whatever. And so that group and others kind of over the next decade or so kind of did a bunch of experiments like similarly structured and found a whole host of benefits, both like psychological, you know, people had improved affect, decreased depression, more empathy, but like some surprising like physiologic changes as well, like people's like EBV titers were higher, their Hep B vaccine titers were higher, they had people with HIV had higher CD4 counts, like these kind of measurable immune changes, which are thought to be driven by decreased cortisol, basically from having processed these traumas through writing. You know, we're not exactly sure why kind of turning an experience into a story works, but there's kind of two theories that are probably both are true. So the first thing that comes to people's mind initially is that kind of like disinhibition, kind of getting it off your chest, you know, getting it out into the world is psychologically helpful. And that's probably true, but it turns out that there's the benefits of writing kind of hold up even if you've already talked about the trauma with a therapist. So there's like something about the writing itself that is beneficial too. And if you look at the stories themselves that people write over the course of those three or sometimes it's 5 days, like, but like these iterative process of writing and like turning an experience into a story that makes sense to other people, you can actually see the way people write about the experience change. So like on the first day, in that first draft, the story is kind of convoluted and they're using pretty negative language, pretty simple language, and also using a lot of like first person pronouns. They're saying I, me, my sort of thing. Whereas on the third day or the fifth day, depending on how the study's designed, they're telling a much more cohesive story. So it's much less of a mess. It's much easier to follow. And they're also using like more complicated language. They're kind of using like coming like cause and effect sort of relationships. You can see that they're not using on that first day. They're using like more removed language, like saying we and they and he and she, like kind of like taking the story out of their own perspective and like kind of shifting to other people's perspectives about the situation. And they're using often more positive language too, that they're like starting to incorporate this trauma into the story of their life, right? Like what we kind of tell people is that, and especially like with medical students, you know, like you say, well, you know, if you look back on your life and you say, okay, like this traumatic event happened at some point, and yes, this was terrible, and yes, this like, you know, shaped who you were in some way, but look where you are. You're, you know, like you achieved this major goal of having been in medical school. And that is part of your story. That trauma was a terrible thing, but it is part of what puts you in this room today. And that it kind of, I think it helps, like turning an experience into a story helps people realize that the trauma is part of their story, but it is not the story of their life. And it kind of helps to recontextualize these difficult experiences into at like part of this greater whole of their, like the story of their lives. We know that there's all this, there's, you know, emotional, physiological health benefits of the writing. And then it turns out that there's like this whole, if you then turn and share that story with others and you're helping them through that community building and empathy building and stuff that stories also are able to do. So it's kind of, it's a kind of a powerful nexus to try to leverage as we try to think about how to, you know, kind of help the health of our medical community at large, and for patients too, obviously, you know, but, you know, since we're kind of housed, in the medical school, we put most of our resources in like in helping our medical providers and community, but we are, you know, also, you know, starting to work with community groups and stuff like that to kind of spread this, you know, outside of our walls as well, which is our next big frontier, I think.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. I think, well, first, to go back a minute, it's just sounds like this really interesting, you said nexus, and I think, you know, you've mentioned the website talks about your, the CFAM website talks about resilience and kind of in helping increase the resilience of, you know, residents and medical students. And whenever, you know, we throw around the word resilience, because it can mean so many things, I'm always interested to see like, well, in this context, what do you mean specifically? And yeah, you just outlined, you know, both like really powerful, it seems like individual, like source of resilience and also community resilience, which is really cool. But yeah, I wanted to ask about patients because there are you know, therapies that use, you know, storytelling, and so it's not necessarily new, but I'd be kind of curious if you have thoughts about how you all are going to approach that, since, you know, there are lots of patient stories that I talk about, you know, trauma within the healthcare system, and like there's, you know, that's a really difficult thing to hear and to kind of try to respond to in some way. So I just wanted to know if you had any thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's such a being part of why we're just starting to kind of move that. I mean, we're a new center, we're only, you know, like 3 years old, but we're we are, you know, it's just such a more daunting task to say, like, you know, like, because, you know, there's only so many medical providers, and there's, you know, millions and millions and millions of patients out there. And so, like, how do you move the needle on that is a lot harder. And I think the answer to that is you do it at the mass media level, or you do it at the, you know, you train people to, like, you know, you train the providers to be kind of more like, to be more open to stories, and then, you know, therefore kind of have them kind of work with their own patient panel. But, you know, I mean, and then we're also limited by being in a, you know, for-profit healthcare system where like time is literally money. And so like having, you know, telling a provider to spend time eliciting their patient's story in a 15-minute visit is not helpful, you know? And so I think that a lot of it has to be sort of extracurricular, you know, like outside of like those 15-minute visits. But like what we're, you know, we're working with, or we're, you know, starting to work with some like community arts organizations to really just to try to help them, like, you know, find money for things they're already doing, like very cool work that they're doing, and kind of helping people like patients and minoritized communities and stuff, kind of tell their stories. And then like on the mass media level, we have this, this partnership with Twin Cities Public Television, and like we are separate from, but deeply intertwined with our storytelling and medicine program. There's this Hippocrates Cafe Productions, which is something that John Hallberg, who's our creative director, started way back in 2009, which used to be like oriented toward like theater productions that kind of discussed complicated healthcare you know, issues through theater and dance and music. And now has shifted, like during the pandemic, shifted to being like filmed versions. And we're kind of sticking with that because we realize that, you know, the reach is so much greater. You know, like you film something once and, you know, millions of people can watch it, and you don't have to like keep putting on performances over and over again. Not that there's still very much value in like live theater, but it's just like, you know, for your, like for the limited resources we have, it turns out that like, you know, you can do a lot more with an hour long TV special than with, you know, with a live performance. And so we've done a series of four shows with Twin Cities Public Television. The first was during the pandemic, it was reflections on the pandemic. Our second one was on the experiences of doctors of color. It was called Speaking of Race. And then the third was on healthy aging. And then we have one coming out in just like on the 28th, I believe, of October. That's will be our last in the series for now. That's called Disability Culture and Creativity. And it's kind of the stories and the performances of these amazing, you know, performers and artists and writers who live with disability. So doing things like that and letting people see that, you know, they're not alone in these experiences either. And, you know, and reaching, you know, a wider art. And all of these shows have been picked up, on the national level and distributed, you know, like in, you know, nearly every state, and two of them have won regional Emmys. And like, so it's like those sorts of things, like they, you know, I think there's momentum there, and it's, and those are all about story too, you know, like, and there's just something really powerful about stories too, you know, that grab people in ways that, like, you know, just telling them facts about what it's like to be a artist with a disability is very different than actually watching that artist do their work and hearing them tell their story, you know, so.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to check those out. And the last thing I want to ask you is, again, a little bit of a diversion, but so as background, so I'm a nurse. I was actually also an English and history major before. And so I can share your kind of excitement about some of this, this stuff. But one thing that really shocked me in nursing school was that there's just really no interaction between nursing students and medical mm-hmm. students, you know, which seemed bizarre to me at the time. And then like even mm-hmm. more bizarre after I started working, like, you know, mm-hmm. we're going to enter into this really difficult job and we have to rely on mm-hmm. each other and communicate with each other. And like, we're not going to practice this at all first. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me as I was, you know, listening to some of this, that seems like that could be an interesting space to do some, you know, interprofessional work. And I was wondering if you thought about that or had any
yeah, absolutely. We have done, you know, like we're a small team, you know, like we have one full-time like staff member, Jenny Magner, is our program manager, and then the rest of us are physicians who get just, you know, like a fraction of our time to do this. So we've been pretty, we've gotten to expand some recently, which is good. We've gotten additional time, but you know, like we're all, we definitely very much want to do this kind of interdisciplinary work, but we're already kind of drowning and stuff just within the medical school. And so it's hard to like, to really branch out too much, but we did do a, we helped the Department of Nurse Practitioner, the DNP students, we did like a small story slam with them last year during their something called Deep Day. That's kind of, everybody together doing a kind of professional development day, and had six or so storytellers. And then we did a presentation on storytelling and like its benefits, like that kind of what we talked about earlier. And then we have, you know, and I'm mentoring a nursing student or a nurse practitioner student as she's doing like a storytelling, like academic project and things like that. So there is starting to be some of that kind of cross-pollination happening. There's also a, in HSEC, the Health Sciences Education Center, we noticed that there was, or the people noticed that there was all these blank white walls that would be great places to put art. And so a group of people came together, including people from CFAM, to kind of create this committee to, you know, to basically design a hanging system and, you know, get submissions for art from people all over health sciences. And really we're kind of shocked at how many people turned out. So we had, I forget how many submissions the first time, but like as many as we like needed to fill the spaces we had money to like hang things on. We just had our second round and I think it was like 160 different submissions. And so there's people from all over health sciences. Additionally, there's now in the medical school, we started, the arts and medicine, or we helped start with students, the arts and medicine interest group for students who were interested in kind of the arts broadly and kind of helping create programming for the medical school. And that we found out there was enough interest from other health sciences like schools to have a similar thing that actually with CHIP, we are actually, they're creating a like that for all of the health sciences. Like, so I think that will be a really powerful way to to get some of these students from totally, you know, like, because I mean, it's not just MDs and nursing, it's pharmacy, it's physical therapy, it's like all these different schools who should be like all doing the same stuff, and they're, you're right, there just isn't. And so it'll be a cool way, I think, to bring people together through, like, you know, shared spaces to create things, but also like to, you know, go watch a movie together, or like, you know, like to, or, you know, a documentary that kind of touches on everybody's like things and stuff. So I hope that there will be more and more of that. And you know, and it, honestly, it's like conversations like this, like finding out that like, oh, Amanda, somebody in public health and nursing who cares about this stuff. And like, let's, when we, you know, like, now we know each other and know to, like, you know, to, when we have ideas, to go to each other. And I think that's a big part of it, is just finding the people who care about this stuff and can kind of, we can all kind of run with our individual things. We're so lucky in the med school that Dean Toler like values this and like supports it. I mean, we're incredibly, incredibly lucky. And so we would love to see the other schools, you know, find ways to invest in this stuff as well, so that their faculty and students can be as invested as we've been able to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this has been such a great conversation. I'm so glad you're able to talk, and thanks for your time. And
appreciate it.
Yeah,
you too.
Have a good weekend. Great. Right, that is our show. Thank you for listening. We're working on our next episode, which will be about children and youth with special healthcare needs. If you have a topic that you'd like the podcast to cover in the future, you can feel free to send us an email at phrj@umn.edu. That's PHRJ for Public Health Review Journal. Thanks again, and hope to hear from you.